Blog Talk Radio.
It's 3 p.m., and I have a question for you. Do you know where your politicians are? Everything is political in your life, from the moment you're born to the moment you die. And when a politician tells you that's not true, look in your pocket. You'll find their hand in it. Everything is political. We will be talking to those politicians that are working for you and talking about those politicians that are working against you. Just because they're a Democrat, or just because they're a Republican, and you voted that way your entire life, maybe you were wrong. Because everybody is not what they seem to be. However, there are a few out there who are working for your benefit, and we are going to bring them to you. We're going to let you hear them. We're going to ask them questions. We're going to let you ask them questions. And we're going to be discussing education system, the military, science, music, sports, oh, and health care. Do you have it? Do you need it? Are your 26-year-olds still on the family health care plan? Or, as the regressive party says, Obamacare. We will bring you what you need to know, because this is the last word. And everything, from the cities, counties, state, nation, the entire world. So sit down and get a pencil, paper, and take this graduate education experience. And we will make sure that you have the last word. My name is Michael Lawson.
They bring the curtain.
Had a birthday, April 23rd. We're still celebrating it, so this is going to be a very, well, I'm going to be on very short time, but I have a load of stuff for you guys here. I got to put up some plaques I got. I got a Danny Don Meredith plaque with Dallas Cowboys. I got a Stanley Cup, my picture is no hitter. I got to put that up on the wall here, and you know, Three Ring Circus. I mean, I just can't believe these clowns. They're all a Three Ring Circus. It's all a Three Ring Circus. I mean, it's. What I want to know is, what are we going to do with all these clowns that have committed the law, committed and broke the law? Forget the guys that went up there and tore up the daggone Capitol building. We know who they are. Show. Or that one. Yeah, pull you back. Okay. We were so rudely interrupted because Skype went off the air. Unbelievable. That's why you couldn't hear me. And I now hear a hum. Why do I hear a hum? A hum in my speakers. Oh, wait a minute. Let me put this down. Okay. Well, I hope we're back up. Let me go into this speaker here. Let's go into this. Any speakers? Okay. Let's see here. If I can get into my system. I don't know if I can get into the system here. Let's see. I don't want to lose anybody, but... We've been out for over an hour. So what I'm going to do is Let's see if I can into the system, make sure that we're back up. Okay, that's good. And I need to get into to make sure, ladies and gentlemen, that we are online. It says I am online, but you never can tell with Skype. So I gotta go into the system and make sure that into settings, I'm making sure I'm in settings, audio, okay, 1, 2, 3. Yes, see, I am not, oh, I am online. Okay, 1, 2, 3. Okay, I'm online. That's it. So let's carry on with the show here. Ladies and gentlemen, I was getting ready to play something for you, and it didn't play. So let's see if it plays right now.
Thank you so much for letting us into your homes on this Thursday. We're so grateful. The Beat with Ari Melber starts right now. Hi, Ari.
Hey, Nicole. Thanks so much. Welcome to The Beat. I am Ari Melber. The January 6th committee is holding at least 8 public hearings this summer in June, beginning on the 9th. One member of that top committee says the hearings will, quote, blow the roof off of the House. The chairman tells NBC News they will be reaching out to Republican senators for interviews soon. And that brings us to a special guest coming up shortly. Congressman Adam Schiff is here live in this segment, as we say on the news, in our top story. He'll be joining me live. We're going to get into it. So that's in a couple moments. What's going on with the committee? Well, the House panel's chairman says Rudy Giuliani is on the short list here to next go under oath. And that comes amidst the revelation that Trump considered using martial law as a way to try to basically stage a coup. If you were to invoke martial law for no reason or for illicit reasons, that would be part of the abuse of potential law enforcement or military power. Now, to be clear, that didn't happen. I bet we'd remember it. If it did, it would happen in public. But the January 6th committee is investigating this focus on abusing emergency powers that was considered by Donald Trump, including declaring martial law, according to Washington Post reporting. The president cannot just declare martial law when he chooses without a reason, without a standard. So the consideration of that is more signs that there was the consideration of coup-like activities. Meanwhile, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene is under a lot of heat. There's an open question over whether she will even be legally allowed to run for re-election. That's unusual in American life. There's also something else unusual, how she, then an incoming congressperson, was texting the chief of staff of the outgoing administration as late as January 17th, saying in our private chat with members, several are saying the only way to save our republic is for Trump to call for what she thought was martial law, like federal marshals. That's a misspelling. She continues, I don't know on those things. I just wanted you to tell him. Now, this matters for several reasons, one of which is, as I mentioned, there's the open suit, which involves her testimony under oath, where lying can be criminal, about what she did and didn't do related to the insurrection. And as you may have heard me say or mention in some of our interviews, it's a high bar to try to legally kick someone off a ballot. It's not yet clear that that burden has been met. But is she lying along the way to stay on the ballot? That is an open question right now, given the mounting evidence and giving her recent and new denials of advocating what you just saw potentially in that text.
Wanted President Trump to declare martial law 3 days before the 2020 inauguration.
I'm sorry, I just don't recall.
Well, those are reportedly my text messages. I think if people read them for themselves, if those are my text messages, they clearly say that I wasn't calling for that. I actually said that's something I don't know about. I don't recall ever advocating for martial law.
And that is a nuance that is fair when it comes to evidence. The text says, I want you to tell him about the push for martial law. It does also say, I don't know. And these are the kind of matters that are not academic. They're not just up to public debates. They are the evidence against her that will ultimately determine if she can run for office again.
Now, this is something that we have to show. This has to be, this is something that has to be talked about. This is something that has to be talked about. So what happens when we don't talk about something like this? What happens? We start getting these people to do it over and over and over again. They don't care how much bull they throw out at you. All they care about is, you know, they have what Hitler did, and sorry I'm using this phrase, but it's getting as bad as he. They repeat the same garbage time and time and time and time again. To where you say, oh, I heard that before. It's got to be true. Because why would they keep saying it if it wasn't true? And you don't realize they keep saying it. They know it's not true. Because they are liars. Just listen. We have two more things I want to play for you. One is what Rachel Maddow has said. And, well, maybe I'll play Michael Cohen first. This is what Michael Cohen said. I'll have Rachel for last. This is what Michael Cohen said. Just listen to what he said.
Michael Cohen, and you're listening to the Mea Culpa podcast. New polling data was released this week that poses a stark problem for President Biden. Younger Americans view him less favorably than older ones do. According to both Gallup and Quinnipiac, Biden is down double digits since the 2020 election. This isn't how it's supposed to be. Young people are expected to be the great future hope of the Democratic Party, with their liberal views influencing their vote for decades to come. Yet, most of the data suggests profound disillusionment. All of this suggests more bad news for the midterm elections. Quite simply, these folks are the ground troops for Biden's Democratic coalition. If they don't turn out on election day, we're fucking screwed.
There is brand new polling out on the presidential approval rating, and it's not good for President Biden.
You know, there was always that thing, oh, Donald Trump has the lowest approval rating at this point in his presidency. We did it over and over and over and over again. Well, at this point in his presidency, Donald Trump's numbers, actually his average approval rating, is 1 point higher than Joe Biden's, which is a 41%, Donald Trump at 42%. A first-term president at this point in his presidency, this is the lowest. This is the lowest for anyone who is elected to the presidency and didn't get up there through the vice presidency. This is a really, really, really bad number.
President Biden's low approval ratings understandably receive a lot of attention. But that doesn't mean Republicans are getting rave reviews either. To the contrary, GOP congressional performance draws even less support than Biden does. And some of their most public stances get thumbs down with the public overall.
If you need any further proof that an aspiring autocrat is leading one of the two major political parties in America, look no further than the votes the Republican National Committee has taken this year. They voted to censure members of their own party, Representatives Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, back in February over their participation in the January 6th committee. In that same vote, the RNC described the attack on the Capitol as, quote, legitimate political discourse. Today, they voted unanimously to pull out of the presidential debates that have been run by the nonpartisan, nonprofit Commission on Presidential Debates since 1988. Trump had repeatedly criticized the commission after his widely panned debate performances in 2020. Today, the Republican National Committee made sure he wouldn't have to suffer through such an ordeal again. Calling the commission biased, the RNC said they would be looking for, quote, newer, better debate platforms, did not elaborate on exactly what those platforms would be.
Take Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson. Republicans spent weeks falsely claiming she is weak on child pornographers and analogizing her representation of detained combatants to representing Nazis. The later accusation of Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas drew a stinging rebuke from the Anti-Defamation League. But poll after poll shows that voters approve of her nomination by much greater margins than recent GOP-nominated justices enjoyed themselves. Republican efforts to smear Jackson have not gone over well with voters.
You know, the last Judge Jackson left the Supreme Court to go to Nuremberg and prosecute the case against the Nazis. This Judge Jackson might have gone there to defend them.
When it comes to the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection, the public is riveted, and the prospect of sending a criminal referral to the Justice Department for Trump and his cronies would be historic shit. Yet, the Republicans in Congress continue to vilify its presence and threaten to shut it down. This, too, is viewed as widely authoritarian and out of step with what mainstream American voters want or expect.
We start with the January 6th probe and the committee flexing its evidence. We are starting to see more incriminating evidence leak out, seeing just how deep the plan to steal the election of 2020 was. Newly revealed text messages obtained by CNN show Senator Mike Lee and Congressman Chip Roy going right to Mark Meadows in full support of those false claims of fraud being pushed by Trump and the MAGA team.
So if the GOP's performance, its cult leader, and its policies are so out of step with the public, why would voters decide to give them back the majority in one or both chambers of Congress? Well, this wouldn't be the first time voters' view defy logical explanation.
But we really could be on the road to Trump 2.0 if Republicans snatch back control of Congress during the midterm elections. And that's what we're looking at, folks. Up for grabs in the Senate, 14 Democrat-held seats and 21 Republican. If just one seat flips red, the scale would tip in favor of the GOP. And listen, if Republicans take control of both chambers, election reform would die. Anti-abortion efforts would be venerated. And CRT bans, which isn't taught in any school anywhere, by the way, could become the law of the land. But here's this. Also, DOA, any attempts by Congress to hold Trump accountable. So say bye-bye to the January 6th investigating committee.
There are a few reasons voters who disapprove of Republicans' performance and don't like their positions may still vote for them. First, voters and the media remain hyper-focused on the presidency. President Biden isn't on the ballot in November, but voting against the Democrats is the only way voters can express their negative view about him. I'm talking about the persuadable middle, not the lunatics who refuse to believe that Biden is their president. I've written those people off as cult victims.
I think that one of the biggest challenges that Democrats have right now is that they're failing to grab some of those folks in the middle, and that's for a couple of reasons. One of them is that the kind of traditional turnout that we think of campaigns needing to do is actually happening at the polls, right? Polls as in the extremes, right? So Republicans are trying to make sure that their newly minted hardcore MAGA heads are still going to turn out for them, right? You saw that kind of question in races like the Virginia gubernatorial, right? Could Glenn Youngkin thread the needle of seeming like he was distancing himself from Trump, but still turning out the far right? And the answer was he did, right? Democrats also have that issue, and this has been alluded to in the last couple of minutes. A lot of voters who have come out for Democrats think, well, what have you done for me lately? And so I think it's really, really critical. We're not going to reach the KIV supporters of the world. We're not going to reach these dog whistle followers. But Democrats certainly, unfortunately, have to take the moral high ground and figure out what are the issues that are going to activate some of these people. It is unfortunately not really democracy, right? And you start to see some interesting wedges when you look even at polling of Republican primary candidates or voters, rather. You can see that these Republican primary voters who don't believe that Joe Biden won the 2020 election also want to have like a minimum wage increase, right? A policy reform that Republicans are never going to give them. So that's a moment and an opportunity for Democrats to try to grab back some of those folks.
Second, the White House and Democrats do a really shitty job of calling out Republicans for their fucking obstruction, their insane radical views, and total antagonism toward things voters care about. Maybe it's coming, but the Democrats have yet to frame the stark choice awaiting voters should they return these lunatics to power.
We have to put Trump back on the ballot, right? That the multiracial coalition, that surge that you spoke of in 2018 and that came back out in 2020, what united that surge was an anti-MAGA, anti-Trump, anti-racism sentiment that really started to bubble up in the summer of 2020. We have to put Trump back on the ballot, but that does not mean that we get to make every Republican seem like Trump. It means that we have to literally explain that if Republicans win the House and the Senate in 2022, they will reinstall Trump in 2024.
Third, according to the Washington Post, one cannot overestimate the importance of inflation in souring voters' mood. They are upset about gas and other price hikes, and that colors their views to an extent Democrats may not appreciate. As the Brookings Institution's William A. Galston warned in an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal, inflation is now, incontestably, the leading issue for the electorate, and voters are giving the Biden administration low marks for handling it.
Since President Biden assumed office, it's the one thing that I said he needed to do is make people's lives tangibly better, make sure their day-to-day experience is better under him than the last guy, because that's what's going to ride on the midterm as well as 2024. And right now, I think the White House is starting to recalibrate. They recognize that people's needs aren't being met. They recognize that their historic economic gains are being eaten up by historic inflation and rising costs in food and housing and energy. And so now I think they're going to try to take bite-sized efforts to combat inflation. We see the president releasing oil every day. We see him requesting waivers for ethanol 15 gas, but there's still more they can do, whether legislatively on top of the Bipartisan Innovation Act, putting forth another push to get an extended child care tax credit, which we know lifted millions of children and their families out of poverty, as well as efforts like canceling student loan debt, which he has already promised to do. It's those efforts that will make sure people are experiencing something different, seeing something different in their bank accounts in real time.
This is a political crisis for Democrats who are battling to retain their House and Senate majorities in highly unfavorable circumstances. And let's be honest, voters are self-interested. Remember the old mantra, it's the economy, stupid. Well, it still is. And when people are paying $6 a fucking gallon to fill their behemoth SUVs, they don't care about much else.
Whether you're filling your gas tank or the grocery cart.
Prices have gone up. Their overall grocery bill has gone up.
From paying the rent to dining out.
We used to eat out like once a week or something, and we hardly ever do that anymore.
Inflation is taking a big bite out of Americans' everyday budgets and savings. The latest report out this morning is expected to show an 8.4% spike from a year ago. That would be the highest since December 1981, when Raiders of the Lost Ark was number one at the box office, Ronald Reagan was president, and unemployment was pushing 10%. But the causes of inflation today are far different. A post-pandemic economic boom. The global supply chain still struggling with China in another COVID lockdown. And the war in Ukraine sending food and energy prices even higher.
The idea of returning both the House and Senate to these lunatics fills me with existential despair. It's almost unfathomable that these people who have done so much to damage this country and destroy democracy will be handed back the reins of power. Time is running out for Biden to turn things around. The GOP's all-culture war, all-the-time playbook has proven surprisingly effective.
Every election that takes place in this country for the short term, given the tack that the Republicans have taken, which is an anti-democracy authoritarianism party, means, Tiffany, that there needs to be that sense of concern and that sense of mobilization, because it's true. We've seen this party become radicalized. We've seen this party completely become unfit for the mainstream and untethered from democracy. And if you turn control of this government over to the Republicans, you are turning over the democracy. Simple as that.
Let's peer into the looking glass for a moment and imagine what the future holds should a GOP midterm sweep come to pass. First, let's look at Election Day. In the battle for the Senate, the chamber is split in a rare 50-50 tie between parties. But technically, the Democratic caucus has the majority because Vice President Harris cast the tie-breaking vote. All Republicans need for the majority is to gain one seat. That's it. Then the Senate would stand at 51-49 with Republicans having a one-vote majority, and Mitch fucking McConnell will stand in the way of anything right or good happening in Washington for the foreseeable future.
There's probably about 9 states at this point that appear to be worth watching in terms of the ones that will determine control. 4 of those are held by Democratic candidates at this point: Arizona, Georgia, New Hampshire, and Nevada, and 5 of those states are held by Republicans. You're looking at Florida, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Now, it's worth noting in those Republican-held states, 3 of those seats are currently open because senators are not running for re-election. Rob Portman from Ohio, Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania, and Richard Burr from North Carolina. So you have some contentious primaries there as Republicans figure out who will be their nominee to replace those retiring senators potentially. There's some primary action on the Democratic side. It hasn't quite become, you know, as contentious in many of those cases. And look, a couple of those states will be difficult for Democrats to flip, right? States like Florida and Ohio, we've seen the popularity and how well Republicans have done during President Trump's years in office, and we'll see how that continues, or if that continues, I should say, you know, without the former president in office and on the ballot. And certainly there are places where parties may be looking to expand the map. Republicans, you know, are confident that perhaps a state like Colorado could become in play if the environment is favorable enough to them. You know, but Democrats, at least when they're looking at the seats that they are defending, feel good about the fact that they have incumbents who are in those races who they believe have a record to run on.
In the battle for the House, Democrats hold a majority by 8 seats. And this is where things could get ugly. First and foremost, Republicans are winning the redistricting fight, which is redrawing the congressional map in favor of the GOP. In many of the battleground states, this will determine which party controls the House of Representatives for years to come. That means Republicans would not even have to win many competitive races to take back the majority. They could conceivably just redraw themselves some or all the way there. So far, the bold moves highlighted by the Biden administration, like the Build Back Better Act, have failed to move the needle for Democrats. Stubborn inflationary pressure, residual fear from the pandemic, and the GOP's relentless culture war have Democratic congressmen on the run.
I'm worried that if Republicans win in the midterm elections, that voting as we know it in this country will be gone. They're already putting as many barriers to the ballot box as possible in Arizona, Florida, Texas, Georgia. And on the other side of the finish line, they're putting in place processes where they could reverse the outcome even if we crawl through glass and run through the fire to get to the ballot box. And so if they are able to win the House, the damage they could do, you know, to permanently make it difficult to vote and just alter the way that we participate in a democratic process could be irreversible. And so this may not be, as I said, this is not only the most important election. If we don't get it right, it could be the last election, because they're also putting in place what I believe is a way to make sure that Donald Trump wins with what they're doing across state legislatures to allow them to reverse the outcome in the Electoral College. And that's why I also put in a link to iwillvote.com, a nonpartisan group that allows you to check your registration status and register to vote if you're not already registered.
Okay, let's pretend now that the nightmare scenario comes to pass. Then what? Since last year, Republicans have increasingly signaled how they plan to exact vengeance on those who tried to make them and their leader, Donald Trump, pay any price for the coup attempt following the 2020 election. For his part, the twice-impeached former president has his own wish list of conspiracy theory-fueled ideas for how to get even, and he has personally pushed other GOP figures to commit to them.
They rigged the election, and now, based on the rigged election, they're destroying our country. Those responsible for wrongdoing must be held accountable. It was a corrupt election. The 2020 presidential election was rigged. We won the election in a landslide. You know it. I know it.
I believe this election was stolen from Donald J. Trump.
What we saw
in 2020, and it's important to have the courage to say it, is that the technology industry, working with Democratic operatives in a few big battleground states, rigged the 2020 election.
Trump has privately told GOP lawmakers, congressional candidates, and operatives in recent months that Republicans on Capitol Hill should be prepared to launch a full-blown fucking investigation to get to the bottom of how FBI agents supposedly caused violence and mayhem on January 6th.
But strangely, some of the key people who participated on January 6th have not been charged.
It's not strange at all. Prosecutors are still building their cases. But Carlson is claiming, without any proof, that the people given anonymity in court papers, the people called unindicted co-conspirators, were actually government agitators there to stoke a riot.
The government knows who they are, but the government has not charged them. Why is that? You know why. They were almost certainly working for the FBI. So FBI operatives were organizing the attack on the Capitol on January 6th.
The theory that the feds somehow orchestrated or caused the rioting at the Capitol is fucking groundless, but it has nevertheless been embraced in influential spheres of Republican politics, in Trump land, and in right-wing media and online culture. The appeal, of course, lies in the attempt to shift obvious blame off the 45th U.S. president and conservatives.
Here's Marjorie Taylor Greene assuming Carlson is right and saying we need names and answers about the FBI operatives who were involved.
Currently, liberals in the Democratic-controlled House are wielding those powers on the January 6th committee, which is ready to make a criminal referral to the Department of Justice for Trump's actions leading up to the deadly Capitol riot and his efforts to nullify Joe Biden's 2020 election win. The former president wants the same thing, but for his version of history, one of these sources who have spoken to Trump about this several times said. And Trump's MAGA toadies on the right are more than happy to back him up. If you're going to have an investigation into January 6th, then let's have an investigation, former Representative Jack Kingston of Georgia, who also served as a Trump surrogate, said recently. Why is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi off limits? Why can't she get all the records in a timely manner? I'd like to see all the FBI informants they were working with, Republican or Democrat. Let's take a look. What was known before the riot by the FBI, and why wasn't it acted on? It would be good to have that after-action review. Go ahead and put it all on the table. Trump's behind-the-scenes push on this underscores how a year and a half after the Capitol assault, the Republican Party's mainstream players have coalesced around a clear strategy to punish the people probing Trump's anti-democratic efforts to elevate conspiracy theory over actual accountability and exculpate the Trumpist perpetrators as fully as they can get away with.
But I think the picture that emerges from talking to his former and current aides, either in Mar-a-Lago or in Washington, is that he feels really unmoored and he really is finding difficulty with the fact that he doesn't have the power to, as you say, influence the course of this, this investigation. If you look at the kind of things he's complaining about that we discussed in the story, he's not happy that House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy didn't put any of his allies on the panel to defend him. You know, this is one of his favorite refrains, that no one is defending me. But he's also upset with people like Jeffrey Clark because they've been invoking their Fifth Amendment, you know, protection for self-incrimination or against self-incrimination. And he thinks this makes them look weak, and he thinks it makes them look complicit in a crime. And he's worried, not that they might get a criminal referral, but it might bounce back and he might get a criminal referral. It's all about him. It's all about the optics. The one thing he did like was Bannon saying, I'm not going to cooperate with the committee at all. He thought that was a really strong image in his eye. But the bottom line is he's no longer president. And the trouble is he can't influence his investigation in the way that he might have done with the Russia inquiry or the special counsel investigation. And I think that really weighs on him.
The formula has become one of the biggest factors driving Trump's own enthusiasm for the 2022 midterms, as well as for the next presidential contest in 2024, when he hopes for rematch against President Biden.
Further, the ex-president's calls for revenge and renewed push to investigate the investigators has now cemented itself as one of the right's guaranteed applause lines as the GOP campaigns to end Democratic control in official Washington. Let's not forget the comments from Newt Gingrich earlier this year when he threatened to jail those who investigated the January 6th insurrection.
You're going to have a Republican majority in the House and a Republican majority in the Senate, and all these people who've been so tough and so mean and so nasty are going to be delivered subpoenas for every document, every conversation, every tweet, every email, because I think it's clear that these are people who are literally just running over the law, pursuing innocent people, causing them to spend thousands and thousands of dollars in legal fees for no justification. And it's basically a lynch mob. And unfortunately, the Attorney General of the United States has joined that lynch mob and is totally misusing the FBI. And I think when you have a Republican Congress, this is all going to come crashing down. And the wolves are going to find out that they're now sheep. And they're the ones who are, in fact, going to, I think, face a real risk of jail for the kind of laws they're breaking.
Beyond January 6th, we can also expect an endless parade of bullshit investigations from the likes of asshole Jim Jordan, who will use his newfound power to indulge in all manner of conspiracy. The Ohio Republican is already planning investigations he aims to launch if the GOP retakes power in the House during the 2022 midterms, and he becomes chair of the House Judiciary Committee next year.
In this next kind of period for Congress, you know, what is that thing that you think, particularly the Judiciary Committee, can have a role in delivering on? No secret, you're the Republican lead on the Judiciary Committee. If we take the majority, you will likely be the first chair of that committee to not be a member of the bar in the history of the committee. Yeah. So walk us through the Jim Jordan vision that for kind of the opening week.
No, that committee has a, I always say, a storied history. You think about Henry Hyde. You think about some of the people who've led that committee. A storied history of defending the Bill of Rights, Americans, the American people's fundamental liberties and freedoms. And right now what we have is a committee that's doing just the opposite. So what we're going to have to do is, one, we're going to have to do the investigations that need done. I mean, this idea that the IRS released thousands of people's tax returns, now that'll probably be, led over in the Ways and Means Committee.
Do you have an investigation subcommittee and an oversight subcommittee?
We definitely need that. We need to look into the IRS situation. We need to look into what's happening with this Justice Department going after parents, this issue that we're focused on right now at school board meetings, what they're doing, the political nature of our Justice Department right now. We need to look into all that. We need to go after big tech, censorship. This thing... What's happening to speech? I always say the five liberties we have under the First Amendment, your right to practice your faith, the right to assemble, right to petition your government, freedom of press, freedom of speech. Speech is the most important, because if you can't speak, you can't really fully practice your faith. So speech is the most important. What big tech in collusion with big government is doing in this cancel culture world we live in is so wrong. Barry Weiss called it the digital thunderdome. You take on the woke mob, they will put you in the Thunderdome. Ask someone as, ask Drew Brees, who said you should stand for the national anthem. Now, Drew Brees is as apple pie as you can get. He is a great American, wonderful Christian family guy, and he had to back down from the mob. This is frightening. But I said this last week. I actually think Americans are going to push back in a big way, and I think the main reason is what happened with Merrick Garland. When he goes after moms and dads, like, wait a minute, this is the last straw. So that's what the Judiciary Committee has to focus on, those fundamental rights we have under the First Amendment, making sure we defend them.
The Ohio Republican currently serves as the ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee. If the GOP retakes control of the House, as many analysts expect the party to do, Jordan would be seen as the most likely lawmaker to chair the legislative chamber's Judiciary Committee. Now that's fucking terrifying. Basically, it will be all conspiracy all the time for the foreseeable future if these fucking assholes assume the majority.
Okay, now I am sorry about that. It was again Skype. We went out four times, I believe, during the playing of that. And I hope everybody was able to keep up with it. But And since we don't have much time, I have to go into Rachel Maddow. This is about, today's show is about conspiracies and how the Republican Party, the conspiracy cult party, has told you time and time and time and time and time again. What you see is not true, and what you hear is not true unless we tell you, unless we show you. If anybody else tells you something, if anybody else shows you anything, it's not true. Do not believe your eyes, your lying eyes. Do not believe your lying eyes. And if you want to believe, I'm trying to believe it was on the, what's her name? The Daily Show that comes on at 4 o'clock on MSNBC, they did a clip of all the Trump lying points. Well, not all, just because there's too many, 30,000 of them. This, where he said this time and time and time again during his speeches, he would bring this particular thing up, and people started to believe it. Because why would he tell us something over and over and over again? Because he wants you to believe it. Now, Rachel Maddow did a major thing on this today, last night, and I need to get to that, so let's play that right now.
And thanks to you at home for joining us this hour. Happy to have you here. So I have a thing for you to put in your calendars.
And I hope we don't go out during this time.
And thanks to you at home for joining us this hour. Happy to have you here. So I have a thing for you to put in your calendars. 6 weeks from tonight, it is June 9th. That's a Thursday. That is apparently when they are going to start.
As many as 8 hearings now? Is that a done deal? Are you still working through that?
Well, 8 is the number at this point. And we are moving forward for June hearing.
Are you going to start at the beginning of the month?
At this point, the first hearing is June 9th.
Can you lay out what those public hearings might look like?
Well, they'll be a combination of exhibits, staff testimony, outside witnesses, just kind of a combination.
Will any of those outside witnesses be people that have testified?
Some of them will be people that people have not heard from before. And I think their testimony will be on point as to why this investigation is so important.
Some of them will be people we have not heard from before. Their testimony will be on point as to why this investigation was so important. That's the chairman of the January 6th investigation, Congressman Benny Thompson, confirming to reporters tonight how the January 6th investigators are going to tell us, tell the public what they have found. It'll start the night, the evening, we believe, of Thursday, June 9th. We don't know exactly what the format is going to be or the length of each of these public hearings, how they're going to do it, but they are planning, at least initially, on having 8 hearings, and we think they're all going to happen during the calendar month of June. At least that's what appears to be the plan now, and they are saying they're going to start June 9th. We shall see. It's interesting, though, having that timeline does give us a little bit more information about where they are in the process, right? If you think about it, Chairman Thompson confirmed today that they are still taking depositions from witnesses, including more depositions that they took today. But, you know, they've been doing all of that behind closed doors. We hear reports about what's happened behind closed doors. We've had committee members talk about some of what they've learned. But, you know, these hundreds of depositions that they've taken, the review of millions of documents that they have obtained, we now know they apparently think that their work overall will be wrapped up within the next 6 weeks. And we know that because on the night they're going public. 6 weeks from tonight, those hearings will start in which they will effectively present their findings. So we know that they think they only need 6 more weeks to wrap this up. We also know from some recent reporting who some of the final witnesses are who they are planning on bringing in. And they include some very recognizable names, the eldest son of former President Donald Trump, Donald Trump Jr. We also learned today that they plan to hear soon from Rudy Giuliani, who used to be President Trump's lawyer, but now presumably he's nobody's lawyer, since thanks to him lying to the courts about the 2020 election, he has at least temporarily been relieved of his law license. Mr. Giuliani had been subpoenaed early on in the January 6th investigation. He's apparently now planning to come in sometime soon to testify. We also expect that at least the request will be made for testimony from some Republican members of Congress, members who may have been involved in the effort to overthrow the government or who may at least have been important witnesses to that effort. All the Republican members of Congress who have thus far been asked to testify, thus far they've all made a big show out of refusing to do that, refusing to testify voluntarily. The committee thus far, the investigators thus far, have not wanted to issue any subpoenas to try to force testimony from members of Congress. We still don't know how any of that will resolve, but now at least we know the time frame on which these questions will be answered or not. We know the time frame on which these matters will be settled. 6 weeks, because that's when this whole thing goes public. You can mark your calendar, June 9th. Julio Cortez is a reporter a photographer for the Associated Press, a photojournalist. Last year, last summer, Mr. Cortez was one of the AP's photographers who was awarded a Pulitzer Prize in Breaking News Photography Achievement. This is one of Mr. Cortez's images. Look at that. That won the Pulitzer for the AP. This was an image that he shot in Minneapolis in the spring of 2020. But about 8 months after he took that image and 6 months before he learned he would win the Pulitzer for it, photojournalist Julio Cortez was on the Associated Press's breaking news team that was covering the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. It was not actually until January 8th, 2 days after the attack, that he was finally able to upload this footage I'm about to show you of a mob of Trump supporters attacking him and grabbing both him and his AP colleague, a man named John Minchillo, who's another Pulitzer Prize-winning AP photojournalist. Mr. Minchillo, at one point, they threw him off the railing of the front of the Capitol, the mob of Trump supporters did. So I'm going to show you about 45 seconds of this video shot by Mr. Cortez. If you have kids watching with you who you don't want to see real-world violence, this is me warning you that this is maybe you should be distracting or something for about 45 seconds or so, because we're going to show you that tape right now. AP photographer John Minchillo, who's the man you saw being menaced and thrown over the railing there, his colleague Julio Cortez, being attacked alongside him. He was the one who shot that footage. Those men are both Pulitzer Prize-winning AP photojournalists. Incredible, right? I mean, lucky to get away with their lives that day when the Trump supporters attacking the Capitol decided they would set upon them. And, I mean, you can see that they're pressed. You can clearly see, Mr. Minchillo at least, right? You can see the long camera lenses hanging off of his gear. You can see his camera, you know? I mean, but they just try to tear him apart. Unless you think that was an isolated incident that day, or maybe they didn't really mean it, this, of course, happened on the same day, same place, that you might remember. Saying CNN sucks, CNN sucks, while they smash up all of that audiovisual equipment, all that that journalism equipment, cameras and lights and microphones and cabling, they're saying CNN sucks because that's the chant that Trump used to lead at his rallies. I don't think it mattered to the crowd that none of that equipment was CNN equipment. It was, I think, again, it was Associated Press equipment, but did they care? I mean, subtlety and precision was never really the point here. The point is something else, something much more obvious. And I have been thinking today about that explosion of violence by Trump supporters against the media on January 6th, against reporters and photojournalists on January 6th. I've been thinking about that today because of what we have just learned about this man. This is the Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech from this past year. They awarded the Nobel Peace Prize this past year to a journalist from the Philippines and to this man that you see on the right side of your screen here, who has been the editor, the leader for decades of a newspaper in Russia called Novaya Gazeta. Novaya Gazeta is an independent newspaper, and his life's work has been trying to keep the independent press in Russia alive by keeping Novaya Gazeta alive. And I say literally alive here, and I repeated that word because it's important to know how often the reporters who work at Novaya Gazeta have been murdered for their work. One of the most celebrated investigative journalists of modern Russia, Anna Politkovskaya, was a reporter for Novaya Gazeta. Much of what the world knows about the truth of Putin's wars in Chechnya, we know because of her intrepid investigative reporting about it. She published a book in 2004 called Putin's Russia, basically sounding the alarm for the West about what kind of man Putin was and what his plans were for his ability to use power in Russia and to use the Russian state. Anna Politkovskaya was murdered 2 years after she published that book. In the midst of her ongoing investigative reporting on the Russian government and Vladimir Putin's regime, she was murdered. She is one of six reporters for that one newspaper who were all murdered in Russia before Putin got to the end of his first decade in power. Six different reporters from Novaya Gazeta all killed in less than 10 years. But Novaya Gazeta kept going. And for the Nobel Peace Prize this year, the committee recognized its leader, its editor, Mr. Dmitry Muratov, for the noble and increasingly impossible work of keeping going, of just continuing to do journalism under the threat of this metastasizing, authoritarian, violent Putin government. Mr. Muratov dedicated the Nobel Peace Prize to his murdered reporters, his murdered employees, including Anna Politkovskaya. In his speech, this was in late December, he warned that Russia was preparing its own population for war, preparing its own population to hate Ukrainians and not see them as human. He warned that Russia was preparing to launch a war against Ukraine. This was him giving that speech December 10, 2021 in Oslo. This was him 3 weeks ago, April 7th. He was on a train out of Moscow, and they attacked him with red paint mixed with acetone. It chemically burned his eyes. He survived, but he was hurt. Again, this is the current Nobel Peace Prize laureate. He has vowed to stay in Russia, even as the Russian government has finally succeeded in shutting down his paper, and shutting down Novaya Gazeta and all other independent journalism in Russia. Putin, of course, has put in place this new law that puts you in prison for 15 years if you even report on or describe the war against Ukraine. And while Dmitry Muratov has decided he will stay in Russia despite that, and he's nearly died for it already, his Novaya Gazeta reporters and editors who have fled Russia, they've just recently, in the past week or two, opened up a new paper, a new entity. They call it Novaya Gazeta Europe, because they can no longer be in Russia while they publish it. They are publishing in Russian and in English, but they are publishing from exile. Well, tonight, there's news here, a dramatic statement to the Washington Post from an unnamed U.S. intelligence official. You see the headline there from the Post tonight. U.S. says Russian intelligence orchestrated attack on Nobel laureate. Quote, the U.S. government has assessed that Russian intelligence was behind an attack earlier this month on a Nobel Prize winner and prominent Russian editor who had criticized the Kremlin's war against Ukraine. Dmitry Muratov, the editor of the independent Russian newspaper Novaya Gazeta, was about to travel on a train out of Moscow on April 7th when an assailant attacked him with a mixture of red paint and acetone, leaving his eyes with a chemical burn. U.S. intelligence has now concluded the incident is the handiwork of Russian intelligence, according to a U.S. official who spoke on the condition of anonymity under rules set by the Biden administration. The official did not give any detail about how U.S. intelligence had come to make that assessment, citing the need to protect sources and methods. The official said in a statement, quote, the United States can confirm that Russian intelligence orchestrated the April 7th attack on Novaya Gazeta's editor-in-chief, Dmitry Muratov, in which he was splashed with red paint containing acetone. So they are making the official who's confirming this finding stay anonymous under Biden administration rules, which itself is tension with the press, right? But the Biden administration is also making that assessment public, saying they know enough to be able to blame Russian intelligence for doing this. This wasn't like some vigilante attack on this editor. This was Putin's government going after this journalist, the current Nobel Peace Laureate. They're blaming Russia for it overtly, saying this U.S. intelligence who knows what they did, they're letting Russia know they knew what they did by telling our own press about it. And you know, this stuff does not happen in a vacuum. I mean, this is happening tonight as our own political right is quite deep into its, you know, the press is the enemy of the people phase. This weekend is the White House Correspondents Association dinner, which the last president didn't go to his whole time in office, and not just because of COVID. It's because the last president literally campaigned against there being a free press. He literally campaigned on that enemy of the people phrase, which he borrowed from Stalin. This weekend, for the first time in 3 years, the Correspondents' Dinner is back on after being shut for COVID. The Biden White House is getting a little bit of a hard time, understandably, about the fact that President Biden is planning to go to the dinner in person. It's understandable. They're getting a hard time for that. It's a controversial decision. It's going to be like 2,000-plus people in an indoor ballroom. The president is 79. The vice president currently, right now, already has COVID. I mean, I get it in terms of, you know, why COVID concerns are enough to make you maybe not want to see President Biden attend this event in person this weekend. On the other hand, I see the other side. It does mean something and something important in this moment now, both domestically and for our role in the world. It means something for a U.S. president to show up, to stand for the press, to stand with the press. Even as the press, I'm sure, drives this president just as bananas as we have every other president and politician since the dawn of time. That's what we do. But right now, it's particularly important for a U.S. president to stand with the press. Because there really is an opposing side here, right, from the other side of American politics.
Now, you know, we have a lot of fake news back there, these fake news.
I'm talking about the fake news media. They are truly an enemy of the people.
The fake news media, right back there.
It's the enemy of the people. Our media is the enemy of the people. It's very, very dangerous what they do.
The repetition is part of the point here. The repetition is part of how that works. The repetition is how it stops seeming shocking and starts seeming like something you've heard before, something that resonates. And that has sunk in. And doing that for that long, right, doing that for the last 7 years, that has sunk in. That has changed things. I mean, you know, at this point, there are not going to be any debates between the next two candidates in the next presidential election. The Republican Party says they're done. They're not doing that anymore because, you know, whether or not the Republican Party's presidential candidate next time around is going to be Donald Trump, the party itself has decided this year that they can no longer abide the fact that it is reporters who ask questions at presidential debates. And so, therefore, there will be no presidential debates in 2024. It's a remarkable decision, and it's on the basis of the fact that the press is involved in asking the questions. The Republican Party can no longer abide that. It's less controversial. It's received way less attention than that, but in Republican-controlled states this year, We've seen a whole rash of new rules and new restrictions put in place that ban reporters from covering state governments, from covering state legislatures in Utah, in Kansas, in Iowa. When they decided to ban reporters from the Iowa legislature this year, it broke what was otherwise a 140-year unbroken tradition. For 140 years, it worked to have reporters in there asking legislators questions. This year, with this Republican Party, that no longer works. Reporters are banned. Last fall, the Republican governor of Missouri, Mike Parson, asked state law enforcement to pursue criminal charges against a local reporter in Missouri because that reporter reported accurately on a security flaw in the state's computer systems. The governor actually got state law enforcement to investigate that reporter for months as if there was some crime in that reporting. They actually tried to bring charges against the reporter, but no prosecutor would do it. I didn't actually think it would get much worse than what we saw from Governor Mike Parson in Missouri, but then this week, hello, California, the Fox News darling conservative sheriff of Los Angeles County convened a press conference in which he put a reporter's photo up on a big poster. He's seen pointing to it there with a pointy stick. Sign says, what did she know and when did she know it? And he pointed out that reporter, who was in fact covering that press conference from the first row at that moment. He said she was going to be the subject of a criminal investigation for this dastardly reporting she was doing on scandals in the sheriff's office. In addition to putting up her photo, he put up a list of alleged crimes he was pretty sure this reporter might have committed by doing this reporting on scandals in his office. Now, we covered that story earlier this week here on this show. We can report tonight that after a righteous and furious pushback, that sheriff is now pretending he never did that. It's one thing to change your mind and say, oh, my bad, I got carried away. Another thing to say, me? No, I didn't do that, you dastardly people, for saying I did. Let's all forget that happened. How about we don't? That hero reporter from the Los Angeles Times is actually going to be here tonight for her first national interview. She'll be our guest coming up in just a few minutes. But this idea that there's a supposed terrible threat from the press, that reporters aren't just irritating to people in power, but actually criminal, that the free press is a threat that must be destroyed, physically destroyed. I mean, this is something that we should get fluent in. I mean, this is an issue that is not hiding its light under a bushel, right? This is not something that you really have to go looking too hard for. I mean, on January 6th, they really did carve the phrase, murder the media, into the U.S. Capitol. They left that behind. Presumably they meant it. This is a thing we should be able to see clearly by now. I mean, even when they're doing it in a way that's more stupid than scary, it's the same thing. It is a tactical pattern that we should see, recognize, and be able to discuss and be able to think clearly about. I mean, this thing that we covered last night with this ridiculous Trump deposition that gave rise to 100 million hilarious fruit-related headlines today. And this deposition he gave where he said you could be killed if somebody threw a tomato at you, that that's a lethal threat that must be met with maximum force. I mean, that undoubtedly was hilarious. It's ridiculous. But that came in a deposition in a case where Trump is trying not to be held accountable for his security guards beating up protesters. Now, the clear impression from the way he talks about protesters is that he would like for people protesting against him to be beat up. That would give him pleasure. He has talked about how that makes the threat of beating up anti-Trump protesters makes Trump rallies, in his words, more fun. He would like to be able to do that. Well, how do you get to do that? How do you get away with something like that? Hype some non-existent threat beyond all recognition to justify and provide a pretext for it, for whatever extreme thing you want to do and get away with. If you want to beat up protesters against you because you enjoy that, you find it fun. But the worst thing anybody can say about the threat posed by that those protesters is that one of them once was rumored to have a tomato? Well, describe a tomato as a lethal threat then. Anybody protesting against you is a lethal threat and therefore deserves maximum force. It's the same tactical pattern over and over again, right? Lock her up, right? Lock her up about Hillary Clinton. Why? What was the ostensible reason they were going to lock her up? Because she used her personal email account when she was working at the State Department. Yes, that's it. And that is such a threat to the very foundations of America that she must be locked up. She must be jailed for that. She should be executed for treason for that. I mean, never mind that it's impossible to find anybody in the Trump administration who didn't use their personal email while they worked in government. Never mind that Trump literally trucked boxes of highly classified material to Mar-a-Lago and left it laying around at his golf club. There isn't actually a real concern about the handling of classified information or government material, like being stored or handled improperly. There isn't a real perceived threat here. But if you can talk about that threat as if it's the worst thing in the world, well, then you can use it as a pretext for what you want to do. And so if what you want to do is jail your political opposition or maybe have them killed, well, hype some non-existent threat that you attach to them beyond all recognition to justify that. That's how you build yourself the pretext you need. Voting fraud. Actual voting fraud is like a handful of old Trump-supporting white men in the villages in Florida and in New Hampshire and Ohio, all voting twice for Trump because they thought no one would notice. I'm just picking those cases out of a hat because those happen to be the ones top of mind, but those are also all the voting fraud cases that have broken in the last few months. You take that invisible, infinitesimal, totally non-consequential threat and turn it into a mechanized million-strong cabal using like South Korean planes and Venezuela and Italian satellites and Jewish space lasers. And pretty soon, you know, voting fraud is the end of America, which surely is enough to justify what it is you want to do in the first place, which is stop abiding by actual election results, take and hold power by force and insistence. Voting fraud is so extreme, we definitely need martial law. Really? Well, if you make voting fraud into an existential threat, then you can justify anything in response to that threat. This is not something we invented. This is not something the Trump era invented. I mean, Russia invaded Ukraine in February, telling the Russian people it was because Ukraine was a military threat gearing up to attack Russia. Really? Russia is 3,000% larger than Ukraine. That's like saying the town of Putney, Vermont was going to invade Mexico, or that Aruba was going to invade China. But still, make the claim. Find a threat, invent a threat, or find one somewhere, and hype it beyond comprehension. Neutralize the bizarreness of that supposed and overhyped threat. Neutralize the bizarreness of it through propagandistic mass repetition, and bingo. Lock her up. Press is the enemy of the people. Ukraine needs to be demilitarized and denazified. Invent a threat out of whole cloth, or take the smallest thing in the world and blow it up into something incomprehensibly massive. And bingo, you have the pretext for anything that you want to do. The time that we are in is the overlap in the Venn diagram between stupid and scary. You are here. This kind of tactic that we are seeing against the press, against voting, against political opponents, it is a tactic that is not new. It is a tactic that we did not invent in this country. But if we can see it more clearly, if we can get more fluent about it in talking about it amongst ourselves, one of the things we will quickly learn is that we can turn to our advantage the learned experience of the people who have gone before us and faced it and fought it before we have had to. And that is what we're going to do here tonight.
Okay, I couldn't get back on again. But now, how is that terrifying? We're going to have to play this again because it was extremely terrifying, I believe, what is going on in this country. These crackpot Republicans, the ones who are leading this outrageous scenario, are crackpots. And we need to find a way to stop them or we're all going to hell in a handbasket. They want what they want when they want it. Every single time, they don't care who gets hurt, why they get hurt, We want this. And what are they going to do when abortion comes around? They will have abortion police out there. And women, I've been saying this for as long as I can believe it. You have let this go. This hurts you. It doesn't hurt men. It hurts women. And every single woman is going to have a major problem. Every woman is going to have a major problem. And what do we do then? What do women do then? It's going to be too late to try anything else. Too late. That's what will be. It will be too late. And we'll be in a world of shit. And I'm telling you, just you wait if they happen to take over. Just wait if they happen to take over. It's going to be outrageous. Outrageous. All right, everybody. I hope you have a better time than I did this weekend. It's my birthday week, and we are going to have a blazing good time. All right, everybody. Have a great day. We'll be right back.